America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, a great and grim and significant day with the terrible, terrible occurrences in Afghanistan. The president is going to be speaking at some point soon. We're just going to a Pentagon briefing where General Frank McKenzie, who is in charge of our forces remaining in Afghanistan, was just speaking about the terror attack that has claimed the lives of at least 12 American servicemen, one Navy medic, 11 Marines. General McKenzie.
So a number of questions there. Let me try to take them in order. So first of all, the threat from ISIS is extremely real. We've been talking about this for several days. We saw it actually manifest itself here in the last few hours with an actual attack. We believe it is their desire to continue those attacks, and we expect those attacks to continue. And we're doing everything we can to be prepared for those attacks. That includes reaching out to the Taliban, who are actually providing the outer security cordon around the airfield, to make sure they know what we expect them to do to protect us. And we will continue to coordinate with them as they go forward. We are continuing to bring people onto the airfield. We just brought a number of buses aboard the airfield over the last couple of 3 hours. So we continue to process. We'll continue to flow people out. The plan is designed to operate while under stress and under attack, and we will continue to do that. We will coordinate very carefully to make sure that it's safe for American citizens to come to the airfield. If it's not, we'll tell them to hold, and then we'll work other ways to try to get them to the airfield. But I think our mission remains. We're still committed to flowing people out up until we terminate operations at some point, you know, towards the end of the month. And but I think we have the ability actually to do all of those things as we go forward. Let me just come back one moment. And you talked about going after ISIS. Yes, if we can find who's associated with this, we will go after them. We've been clear all along that we're going to retain the right to operate against ISIS in Afghanistan. And we are working very hard right now to determine attribution, to determine who is associated with this cowardly attack, and we're prepared to take action against them. 24/7, we are looking for them.
David. General McKenzie.
General David Martin with CBS. 27 casualties is a terrible number. 12 dead. Could you explain the circumstances of these attacks, which resulted in such high casualties for the U.S.?
Sure, David. So first of all, you will understand that we're still investigating the exact circumstances. But what I can tell you is this. The attack occurred at a gate. And at a gate, we have to check people before they get onto the airfield. We have to ensure they're not carrying a bomb or any other kind of weapon that could ultimately make its way onto an aircraft. So that requires physical screening. You can't do that with standoff. You ultimately have to get very close to that person. So while the airbase itself is surrounded with T-walls, we're well bunkered in. We've done a variety of things to protect ourselves. At these interface points, these gates where people actually come on the airfield, there's no substitute for a young man or woman, a young United States man or woman, standing up there conducting a search of that person before we let them on. Now, the Taliban have conducted searches before they get to that point, and sometimes those searches have been good and sometimes not. I will simply note that before this attack, we had passed 104,000 people through. So this attack is one too many, but we'll evaluate what happened. We'll find ways to always get better. But the key thing is, you don't want to let somebody on an airplane carrying a bomb, because that could result in even massive loss of life if an airplane were to be destroyed. So you got to do the searches. We work with our Afghan partners on the ground, the NSU elements, to conduct those searches. But ultimately, Americans have got to be in danger to do these searches. There's really no other way to do it. And again, I cannot tell you how impressed I am with the daily heroism of the men and women that are out there doing this work. Typically soldiers, sailors, and Marines that are doing that work. And they're right up close to thousands of people that are flowing through the airfield. You've all seen the images. And to be able to get up and do it day after day is remarkable. And this time, looks like somebody got close to us. We'll find out why. We'll try to improve our procedures. It is 12 service members dying. Nobody feels that more closely, directly than me and everyone else in the chain of command. And we recognize that we need to continue to evaluate our procedures as we go forward. Same time, there's a tension there. We have to continue to let people own the airfield, because that is why we are there. We're not there to defend ourselves. We're there to defend ourselves while we process American citizens first, but also the other categories of people that I've mentioned, get them to a place where we can fly them out into a safer, better future.
So just to be clear, this suicide bomber was going through the gate being searched, checked by U.S. service members when he detonated his vest?
David, that would be my working assumption. I know this, he did not get inside the, he did not get on the installation. It was at the interface point where they try to come in where this attack occurred. And we just don't know more right now. We're gathering that information. As you will understand, we're investigating that. But right now our focus really, we have other active threat streams, extremely active threat streams against the airfield. We wanna make sure that we've taken the steps we need to take to protect ourselves there. So our focus is on that. Over the next
this
few
is,
hours,
General
two.
Kenneth F. McKenzie, Kenneth Frank McKenzie, he's known as Frank, who's the Marine Corps general who currently serves as 14th commander of the United States Central Command. He is in charge of the operations currently going on in Afghanistan. The key matter that everybody is waiting for here is it's been over 5 hours now. From the time that these explosions first occurred. And before the explosions occurred, it was eerie. It was in the middle of the night last night, American time, there were urgent announcements to people not to come to the airport because they expected this attack which was not from the Taliban, it is from ISIS-K. And apparently, ISIS-K and the Taliban are deadly enemies. At least that is what we understand. And we will be talking about this with a number of people, including the leading historian of this Afghan war, whose last bloody and horrible chapters, let us hope they are the last, are being written right now. But the thing to think about here is the mind of a terrorist criminal. Is think about the depravity. This is not, well, there are people occupying our country, we want them to leave. What's happening is people are trying to leave and to leave safely and with some modicum of decency. And yet there are two people at least who want to give up their lives to blow themselves into little bloody chunks of flesh in order to kill children and in order to kill Americans who are doing the humanitarian work of trying to allow people to get out of that hellhole without further damage. What is President Biden supposed to say at this point? And it's not surprising, especially given the bumbling and the fumbling and the back and the forth and the utterly incompetent manner in which all of this has been handled, but we need some clarity. And we also need some bipartisanship. I don't think this is a good time to talk about what are the political implications and who's going to win which congressional district and which side does this help. This hurts America. And unless we get some actual answers, aside from General McKenzie, who is explaining as much as he can, well, what we know today, just found out recently from what he said that apparently this was a suicide bomber, what they used to call homicide bombers more appropriately, because the killing of themselves is just an incidental to their desire to kill. Well, most of the casualties here are Afghans, and they are not necessarily Afghans who were working hand in glove with the Americans, though some of them are. They're people trying to get out, to leave you alone. And the disruption of this process, who does that help exactly? And what kind of warped religious cult actually believes that this kind of end of your own life, blowing yourself up, blowing you up into little bits of flesh again for the interest of killing Americans doing humanitarian work, that is something that God wants? That God of any form, any recognizable form, that is something that God would glorify and welcome. We will get to more on the very latest. We also do eagerly await a statement from the president. About time. We'll be right back. On On the Michael Medved Show, we are just seeing the conclusion of the Pentagon press briefing with General McKenzie, who is the Marine Corps general who's the commander of Central Command. And what's remarkable is that with so much focus on the Taliban, all of a sudden we wake up today and the news that you hear at least portrays the Taliban as on our side. They've condemned the attack from the beginning. They've condemned the attack as gruesome and horrible, and the Taliban knows something about gruesome and horrible. But one of the things about the Islamic terrorist organizations, operations that we have always fought is they've always hated each other. They compete in terms of how many Westerners, how many Americans, how many infidels they can liquidate and kill, at the same time that they want to outdo each other and kill one another. The original story on the bombings, it was covered at around 2 p.m. Eastern Time, so you can do the math, not quite 3 hours ago. The story was covered on Fox News by Jen Griffin with the initial numbers that have since been superseded. Here's what it sounded like at 2 p.m. Eastern.
We have even more devastating news to report. We've just learned that the death toll for U.S. service members has risen. We can report at this time that at least 10 U.S. service members, Marines and soldiers, have been killed in that bombing outside Abbey Gate, the suicide bombing attack that occurred this morning outside Abbey Gate at the airport in Kabul. So what we know at this moment in time is that there were two explosions. There was a suicide bombing that struck outside the gate at the airport where the U.S. Marines were guarding the entrance at Abbey Gate. There was a second explosion, likely a vehicle-borne IED, a car bomb, at the Baron Hotel, which is about 200 yards from that gate. We can tell you that at this moment, the Americans who were killed, the American service members who were killed at Abbey Gate.
Okay, and there were a total now, they have confirmed, of 12 American service members, God bless them, who have lost their lives, sacrificed their lives for their country, one Navy medic and 11 Marines. There are horrific videos, unfortunately, that are flooding social media, showing dead and mutilated bodies, badly mutilated bodies, adults and children alike, were literally piled up in the streets. Some of the American military medical facilities that are there at the Hamid Karzai International Airport, that those facilities are being used to treat not only wounded Americans, there are reportedly 20 wounded Americans, in addition to the 12 fatalities. But those medical facilities are being used to treat wounded Afghan civilians as well. And of course, this whole process of trying to get people out and trying to get to people to the airport has been just broken, stopped, dead. And again, we still have not heard from the White House. This has not been a rapid response. And the more time that goes by with the entire situation and such profound doubt, in other words, President Biden basically has to choose one of two directions. There's one direction that I think would be disastrous, profoundly long term, which is the direction of simply now saying, okay, we're going to keep to the original deadline. We are going to try to keep our people out of harm's way and just expedite leaving Afghanistan. And the other kind of resolution would be the kind of resolution that, well, for instance, Ben Sasse, who is a member of the Intelligence Committee, Select Committee on Intelligence for the House and Senate, he declares, this is the nightmare we feared and why for weeks military intelligence and congressional leaders from both parties have begged President Biden to stand up to the Taliban and push out the airport perimeter. Mr. President, there is a clear choice before you now. Either rip up the August 31st deadline and defend evacuation routes by expanding the perimeter around the Kabul airport or by retaking Bagram, or leave our people behind in your retreat. We simply cannot strand Americans behind enemy lines in the new capital city of global jihad. You are the commander-in-chief, sir. Reverse course and fight for our people. This is likely to get worse, and weakness will accelerate the bloodshed. Lord have mercy on Americans in harm's way. So says Senator Ben Sasse, Republican of Nebraska. And then there is this testimony, which is heartrending, that was on CBSN. And it's from an Afghan interpreter who witnessed the airport blast, telling his story. This is clip four.
When I got told the explosion happened, and I just saw a lot of people got hurt and people that were laying on the ground, I saw a baby girl, and I went to her, and I picked her up and started taking her to the hospital. I put her in a vehicle, started driving. There was a lot of traffic there, so I had to get up and pick her up again. I took her to the hospital, but she died on my hand, so. And that's heartbreaking, and what is going on right now, it's heartbreaking. This whole country fall apart.
You can imagine someone who knows that he's going to wake up the next day in Afghanistan, and the next day in Afghanistan. And the horror of this particular attack, to achieve what purpose? To drive the Americans out? Frankly, I think it's going to have and should have exactly the opposite purpose. In other words, it should stiffen our resolve to make sure that at the very least we get out every individual who wants to come out fairly. There are reports that the someone, unclear who or why, fired on one of these planes, big airplanes, that was departing. It was an Italian plane. And there were people on board the plane and people on the ground who confirmed that there was gunfire. Now, some people say that was celebratory gunfire, people firing in the air to celebrate the Taliban victory. Who knows? Imagine the dangers that are going on. They're trying to keep the planes running and taking people to safety. And all the more reason why President Biden made a gigantic mistake to evacuate in the dead of night without even notifying all of our allies the Bagram Air Base, which is would have been much easier for Americans to secure for these evacuation purposes. We will be right back with more on The Michael Medved Show. When it comes to Afghanistan, which has such a tortured and troubled history, you can understand what's going on at this moment far more effectively if you have some perspective on the past. And no one has a more accomplished perspective on the past than my guest, David Loyne of the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC. He's the author of an upcoming book, and haven't seen it yet because it isn't released yet. It'll be released in about 2 weeks. The book is called The Long War, The Inside Story of America and Afghanistan Since 9/11. And David is a visiting senior fellow in the War Studies Department at King's College, University of London. He is also someone who began reporting from Afghanistan in person in 1996 when the Taliban first took over Kabul. Mr. Loyne, thank you very much for making time for us today. The first
Michael,
question.
I'm, It's really good to be on your show. And may I say, with extraordinary shock of the news that has just hit America. And I mean, my sympathy goes out to you.
Thank you. And what I hope you could explain about that is one of the things that we're hearing from all sources is that ISIS-K is the likely culprits in these evil suicide bombings.
They've admitted responsibility.
They've admitted responsibility. They've probably boasted of responsibility.
They put out a statement. There's a website that tracks everything they're saying. They put out a statement claiming that they did this.
Okay, my question to you, is it true that this ISIS-K organization, a sort of split off from the Islamic State group, are actually mortal enemies, bitter enemies of the Taliban?
That's a complicated question, Michael. It's a really good one. I mean, yes, in principle, they are. So from the senior level, there is a major argument. And believe it or not, it's weirdly a theological argument. When Islamic State began in Syria, they proclaimed a caliph, you'll remember. They said that they were the caliph and restoring the caliphate, which was something destroyed a century ago at the end of the First World War. And the Islamic world ever since has wanted to restore some sense of this overall figure who ran the Islamic world. And so they declared a caliph, and the Taliban already had an emir al-Mu'mineen, the master, the commander of all the faithful, which they claimed to be the leader of the Muslim world. So there was a sort of theological argument, believe it or not, that went on between Syria and the back streets of the Taliban over whether you could have a caliph and an emir at the same time. And since then, so there's an argument in principle. There's also an argument on the ground, because since then, Islamic State has been used by dissident Taliban commanders in Afghanistan who've replaced the white flag of the Taliban with the black flag of Islamic State. And it has the Islamic State Khorasan group, which is what they've declared in Afghanistan, has a curious mythical status in Islamic millennial prophecy. There's an old prophecy that when the end times came, the Mahdi would come riding in on a horse in a country called Khorasan, with the land of the black flags. And Khorasan is an old name for the area west of Afghanistan, sort of northwest Afghanistan, a bit of Iran, a bit of Turkmenistan. And it's not been used for 600-700 years to be real space in the world, but it's a mythical space in Muslim minds. And so Islamic State Khorasan has a real draw on young jihadis, young men who want to, you know, blow themselves up, as we saw so tragically today. So they're a much more extremist group, beginning with dissidents from the Taliban, but they're quite close to elements in the Taliban and elements in the Haqqani network who are allied with the Taliban. You know, their brothers marry each other's daughters. I mean, there's a sort of sense in which they're very knitted together, although fundamentally different in leadership.
Okay, with this complexity, Mr. Lloyd, if you were
advising...
Sure,
that was an awful lot of Islamic history in one answer.
Yes, which I appreciate, and it's very important. But if you were advising Prime Minister Johnson or President Biden at the moment about a way to respond to prevent a repetition of what happened today and the loss of all the civilians and the 12, at least, American servicemen, what would be the most important way to prevent a repetition?
Well, it's really interesting, potentially engaging with the Taliban and trying to bring the Taliban into trying to really get the Taliban to deliver on the words that they have and follow those with deeds. The Taliban say that they're different from what they were in the late 1990s. They say they want an inclusive government. They've kept the mayor of Kabul in office, who was very close to former President Ghani. In fact, he was his spokesman during the last presidential election campaign. And so they're clearly reaching out across the aisle and still negotiating some sense of what this inclusive government's going to look like. And if the international community could persuade the Taliban to, you know, back up their words with actual deeds and to ameliorate some of the sort of cultural destruction that they've had in the past, and their views on women, which frankly haven't changed, then there could be, you know, some way that perhaps we could deal with them. They don't have any money at the moment, so there might be some leverage in terms of unlocking money. And then engage the Taliban and say, well, look, here's this Islamic State. You say you're against them. And General McKenzie today has, the commander of CENTCOM, has effectively said in a press conference that he's relying on the Taliban to carry out better security near the airport, which clearly didn't happen on this occasion. And there's some indications that he's sharing intelligence with them in order to be able to do that. So there is this tactical relationship on the ground. And perhaps, you know, if President Biden could use leverage, you know, in order to get the Taliban to keep Islamic State in check, that might be one thing he could do. But having lost this war and the debacle of the departure with this appalling tragedy at the end of it, there are, frankly, very, very few things that the United States can do. It is belittled by the loss, by the defeat in Afghanistan.
General McKenzie, who you mentioned before, the commander of CENTCOM, was saying in his press briefing less than an hour ago, he was hinting at some kind of strong response, military response, aimed at ISIS-K. Is that even conceivable, or is it a good idea?
Well, it's very hard to, you know, who do you hit? Where do you hit? Back in 2017, America dropped the largest ever non-nuclear device ever dropped by the United States on a cave complex in eastern Afghanistan, the so-called MOAB, mother of all bombs. And that cave complex was in the hands of Islamic State Khorasan in Afghanistan. And, you know, at the time, they were believed to be only a few dozen of them, but they were strong and they'd taken part of that eastern province. And they're a very, you know, difficult enemy, even with the biggest conventional weapons you've got, literally the biggest conventional weapons you've got. It's hard to find them. It's hard to move against them. And of course, not having any boots on the ground in Afghanistan, America's lost all its intelligence capacity. Where are they? So you're back to a very difficult situation in terms of being able to respond to an organization like this. Although, you know, I can quite see the need for General McKenzie to say what he did and to hit back and to hit back hard. But who is a real question.
And we will see what President Biden has to say supposedly any moment. I understand that you can stay with us and maybe to answer what is the most discomforting question, I think, for many people here in the United States, which is what is the best possible outcome for this chapter in Afghan history, best possible outcome for the U.S., and what is the worst possible outcome, which may be an even more pertinent question right now. We'll continue the conversation with the author of The Long War, historian David Loin, coming up. On the Michael Medved show, waiting on President Biden to give his reaction, and it's an unusual delay. We do have David Loin with us, and it's a great privilege to have him. He is the author of a new book. It's an upcoming book. It'll be released in about 2 weeks. It is called The Long War, The Inside Story of America and Afghanistan Since 9/11. Mr. Loin, we were speaking before about people have already described what just happened today as President Biden's worst nightmare. And I wanted to ask you what would be first, perhaps, what would be the worst nightmare in terms of the weeks and months ahead in Afghanistan? And what would be the best possible outcome for America and for the rest of the world? On the other hand, if things broke in a more constructive direction.
Let me do the gloomy scenario first.
Because that's probably more likely.
There's an awful lot of things that could go very wrong. The Taliban are supported by Pakistan, and Pakistan is a volatile, nuclear-armed country with a huge potential Islamist problem of its own. It's got its own Taliban, who are allied to the Afghan Taliban, who want to bring down the Pakistani state. So this complex set of allegiances there. And the Pakistani government, of course, would say that it's not in control of the Taliban, but they're very happy to have them in power. And there's certainly been a lot of accounts from people in Afghanistan hearing Pakistani accents, hearing Taliban commanders who are obviously Pakistani, Punjabis and people from across Pakistan. So, keeping some sense of Pakistan, a volatile, Islamist, nuclear-armed power, not collapsing, feels like something that's quite important in terms of policy. And that's why not engaging in Afghanistan is not an option. We can't just walk away. That's the worst element that could happen. And the way that that'll happen is if Afghanistan really does sort of collapse further into more Syrian-like fighting, huge numbers of refugees across the region, Islamic State growing much stronger, fighting with the Taliban, no sense of civic order. And that could happen. The alternative scenario, and there are other scenarios, are that this is a very unstable administration. The Taliban are not that large. They don't yet control the whole country. That Kabul fell so quickly was as much a surprise to them as it was to those of us who watch Afghanistan very closely. I was talking to senior British military figures only a week before the fall of Kabul, who agreed with me that this would take months, potentially years, before the Taliban went into the city. And that was the extreme intelligence assessment. Now, there were some other intelligence assessments that said it was going to go much more quickly, but I think no one really expected it to be that quick. So the Taliban are slightly in disarray at the moment. We're hearing a lot of reports from the streets of Kabul that they're in disarray. They don't know how to run a sophisticated government. This is a very, very different country to the country that they took 25 years ago when I was effectively embedded with their forces when they took Kabul in 1996. Then, Kabul had been destroyed by a vicious civil war at the end of a long Russian occupation, and it was poor. Now, it's a much more sophisticated country. The intervention was not completely in vain. It wasn't a nation-building intervention, but there was an awful lot of money that went into development, and it made a difference. Although some of it was wasted, it did make a difference. We've left behind a society where people expect something different from what the Taliban are willing to offer them. So already we've seen some pretty brave rallies of resistance against the Taliban, people flying the Afghan national flag that the Taliban now want to replace with their own white banner. And as well as that, there's armed resistance. There's one province still holding out against them, the Panjshir Valley, two and a half hours, 3 hours drive north of Kabul, which has a mythical place in recent Afghan history because it held out against the Russians in the 1980s and it held out against the Taliban in the 1990s.
That was under Ahmed Shah Massoud, right?
That's under Ahmed Shah Massoud, the man who was killed 2 days before 9/11 by a bomb in a TV camera planted by an al-Qaeda cameraman. And his son, Ahmed Massoud, who actually studied at in the War Studies Department where I am in King's College, but I have to say it's not a practical course. He did a master's in war studies, but he's very young and not tested in war. But the Panjshiris are tested in war, and lots of soldiers who didn't want to surrender to in the way that the army collapsed in recent weeks are there, and they've taken their kit there, and there's other soldiers beginning to trickle in, and they're led by Amrul Asali, who is a former guerrilla fighter, former head of the intelligence service, very well networked individual, former CIA operative. Has spent a lot of time in the U.S. and knows America very well. Now, it's one of the challenges for America once the evacuation's over and we see what kind of a government the Taliban's going to be, as to whether to support that resistance movement, and whether to do it in a joined up way for the international community. Because I think there will be armed resistance against the Taliban growing in the coming months. And so the best scenario, I guess, is that the Taliban are unstable, and that movement can unite the country in some way, not divide it as it has before when Ahmad Shah Massoud was there and just one of a number of guerrilla groups. And you could see, you know, potentially, again, more fighting, but the result of that fighting, a different sort of Afghanistan and one taken by the Afghan people rather than with major international boots on the ground.
Don't you think there would be tremendous, because your book is about Afghanistan and America, that there would be tremendous opposition in our country to any re-involvement in any fighting that's going on, no matter how romantic or credible or appealing the figures offering that resistance to the Taliban may be?
There are things short of fighting. One of the things that could happen is not recognizing the Taliban as the administration of Afghanistan, which in the 1990s the international community didn't do, and the excuse for not doing it then was that Ahmad Shah Massoud still held that region in the northeast of the country. If his son and Amrullah Saleh and their forces can increase their footprint a bit, perhaps move up as far as the border, which his father did before, then that would be an excuse to say, well, that's the legitimate government of Afghanistan, because Amrullah Saleh was the vice president. He's declared himself president of the republic. We could say that's the surviving republic, and withhold major financial support from the Taliban, but give financial support to that group. That's not boots on the ground, but it would potentially change. It'd be a game changer in Afghanistan if that sort of support came in.
I'm speaking to David Loyne, who is a senior fellow at King's College in London, at the University of London. And he is the author of the new book, The Long War, which is coming out 2 weeks from now. He's been covering the events in Afghanistan since 1996. And he acknowledges that he's one of those people who was shocked at how quickly the Taliban actually took control of the country. And who knows, maybe with what Mr. Loyne is saying now, there may be some unexpected speed and challenges to the Taliban and to their attempts to rule the nation of Afghanistan. In terms of the involvement of nuclear weapons in Pakistan, that one hopes is a distant prospect, a remote prospect? Yes, I was just saying, we're just about at the end of our time, but the most
in terms
grim...
of nuclear weapons, well, Pakistan has nuclear weapons, and if the Taliban were to move into Pakistan with any sort of strength, and Pakistan were to collapse, that's the most dangerous scenario. And that's the only opportunity for the Taliban to actually get hold of nuclear weapons. There's no other way that they would do it.
Yeah. Again, when you hear of 150 nuclear weapons in Pakistan, that makes the grim events of today seem far less horrifying than other possible eventualities. David Loyne, appreciate your time on a grim day. We are still waiting on the President of the United States. Almost surely he will be speaking at some point in the next few minutes, or certainly within the next hour. We will go to him. We'll also be speaking to Frank Luntz about American public opinion and the war in Afghanistan and the war on vaccines and more in this greatest nation on God.